amazing of chanting both Japa and Harinam Sankirtan at Wada. And you know, the way he just brings out those memories, it is so enlivening. You're just transported to that period and you just feel that you're traveling with Srila Prabhupada. And we are very fortunate that he's here this morning and he's going to be speaking. So what he has done is, from his transcendental diary, he has collected topic-wise various pastimes. So today's topic is going to be on association, the satsang. And at the end of his presentation at around 10 o'clock, then he'll be making a short presentation on one of the projects he's involved with, very important project, which is on preserving all of our Acharya's texts, you know, some of our Gaudiya literatures, which were kind of, many of them in a dilapidated state or lost or not yet recovered. So he, along with one devotee called Pranava Prabhu, are running this Bhaktivedanta Research Center. So this is an important initiative for preserving the Gaudiya literatures. And this happens to be in Kolkata, so he'll just make a presentation on that also, starting at 10. Thank you very much. Let us welcome him by loudly chanting.
Haribo!
Haribo!
Jaya Radha Madhava Kunja Bihari Jaya Radha Madhava Kunja Bihari Gopi jana balaba giribar dhari Gopi jana balaba giribar dhari Yashoda Nandana Braja Janaranjana Yashoda Nandana Braja Janaranjana Yamuna Tira Banachari Yamuna Tira Banachari Jaya Radha Madhava Kunja Bihari Hare Krishna. Srila Prabhupada ki jai. Just don't mind. A little word about the Prema Dhwani there. Actually, Prabhupada taught us that when the Prema Dhwani is being said, everybody should bow down with their foreheads on the floor. I see many of you who just... The forehead should touch the floor. That's the point. Yeah? Okay, so this morning, instead of the regular Bhagavatam class, I'm going to do another segment of a seminar that I present when I usually travel, Srila Prabhupada, the Living Bhagavatam. This is based on the diary that I was keeping when I was fortunate enough to travel with Srila Prabhupada from late 1975 through 1977. So most of the material here is taken from that. There may be a few segments from other places to augment that. What I've done is, rather than, of course, take a chronological approach, which is the way a diary is written, I've taken a thematic approach, and various topics or aspects of devotional service, I've tried to compile anything that Prabhupada said or anything that happened in relation to that particular topic, put it into some kind of order, and then I present that. So I have about 7 or 8 different themes at the Govardhan Echo Farm. As Gauranga Prabhu was just saying, we just had a couple of days, 3 days, talking about the topic of chanting. This morning I thought it would be nice to talk about the topic of association. So this is not meant to be everything Prabhupada ever said about association. It's just meant to give us a little glimpse into the principle, and from that you can extrapolate that into your own daily activities. The idea is, of course, that Krishna consciousness is not a theoretical process. It's very practical. Yeah, we read the books, but then what's in the books has to be assimilated by actual practice. So Prabhupada, of course, was the expert in the practice of Krishna consciousness. He knew the topic very thoroughly, and he lived it. That's the principle of the living Bhagavatam. Not that we just read the books, but we actually live what's in the books, and then we realize what the books are all about. So we'll have about an hour or so on this topic, and then we'll switch over to the PowerPoint presentation with the Bhaktivedanta Research Center, the project that we've started in Calcutta a couple of years ago. Is that all right? Yeah. Okay, thank you. Okay, so we're on the topic of association. I've got to adjust this table a little bit here. So just as an overview of the principle, Prabhupada in the Bhagavad Gita, he gives a very nice purport, chapter 9, verse 32, where he mentions there that everybody is eligible for the supreme destination. In the Srimad Bhagavatam, it is stated that even the lowest, who are called chandalas or dog eaters, can be purified by association with a pure devotee. Therefore, devotional service and the guidance of a pure devotee are so strong that there is no discrimination between the lower and higher classes of men. Anyone can take to it. The most simple man taking shelter of a pure devotee can be purified by proper guidance. And then another little snippet from a purport in the Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 3, Chapter 22, Verse 5. What is not possible to achieve in thousands of lives can be achieved in one moment if there is an opportunity to meet a saintly person. It is therefore enjoined in the Vedic literature that one should always try to associate with saintly persons and try to disassociate oneself from the common man. Because by one word of a saintly person, one can be liberated from material entanglement. So that's the principle on which Prabhupada started the International Society for Krishna Consciousness, to have the opportunity to associate with like-minded persons who are interested in developing their relationship with Krishna. There's so many different arrangements in society, different clubs where people meet together, to pursue their common interests, just like you have the Rotary Club or the Lions Club or this club or that, football clubs, yeah, in the West, cricket clubs, laughing clubs, so many different clubs where people get together and by association they become encouraged in the topic that they want to pursue. So if you want to be a businessman, you have to associate with businessmen. If you want to, you know, do anything, you have to learn that from others. Nobody does anything in isolation. We are, as Prabhupada said, social creatures or social animals. So a man is known by his association, and whatever habits the persons have that you associate with, automatically you'll imbibe that, even without trying. Because if you want to stay in the association of a particular group, if you don't talk like them, if you don't act like them, if you don't think like them, if you don't eat like them, then obviously you can't be a member of the group. So if you want to be a devotee, you have to join the group of devotees, the sadhus, sadhu sangha. And that principle makes it possible, easily possible for us to progress in devotional service. So therefore Prabhupada was very keen right from the very beginning to set up the opportunity, a society, the opportunity for people to join a society which is simply about spiritual life. So February the 23rd, 1976, Prabhupada was in Mayapur, and in his class in the morning, he described the important role that the temple plays in helping people to advance in spiritual life by agyata sukriti, or unknown pious activity. Sukriti, Prabhupada said, means the way by which we can approach the Supreme Personality of Godhead. That is called Sukriti, and agyata sukriti. So this temple means the chance to the people in general, agyata sukriti, that anybody who will come to this temple where the deity is there, and even by imitating others, if one offers his obeisances to the Lord, that is taken into account. That is not useless, because this is Krishna's desire. He gives the four principles. Anybody know what the four principles are? What are the four principles that Krishna gives? Good man. Thank you very much. Somebody's thinking. Manmana bhavamad bhakto majaji mam namaskaru. Twice Krishna says that in the Bhagavad Gita. These are the four principles by which you can become very dear to Krishna. So, always think of me and become my devotee, worship me, and just offer a little obeisances. These four principles will deliver you from this bondage of material existence, and without any doubt, you'll come back to me. So simple thing. It is not at all difficult. A child can do it. An old man can do it. A learned man can do it. Or without any knowledge. Even an animal can do it. So very simple. Bhakti yoga is very simple. Prabhupada stressed that any person can advance, even unknowingly, simply by gaining the association of devotees. And our temples offer that opportunity. Therefore, somehow or another, he said, if somebody comes to the temple, and even by imitating, one offers obeisances. So we have seen so many persons. Our devotees are offering obeisances. So they all think, oh, it is the etiquette, let me also do that. So, by association. Therefore, it is recommended, sadhu sangha. Simply by association, one can be delivered. It is so nice a thing. But unfortunately, they'll not associate with the sadhus. So Prabhupada set up temples all around the world. Little, what they call, like a little oasis, thank you. Yes, a little oasis where people can come and have a direct experience of the principles of spiritual life. So that sadhu sangha then, of course there's that famous verse, in the Majalila of the Chaitanya Charitamrita, sadhu sangha, sarva shastri koi, lavamatra sadhu sangha, sarva siddhi hoi. So, in that, it says that the verdict of all revealed scriptures is that by even a moment's association with a pure devotee, one can attain all success. So, when we first read that, because the Chaitanya Charitamrita came out in 1975, and when we all read that, we were naturally thinking, what does that mean, Lava Matra? It's sometimes translated as 1/11th of a second. That's one moment, 1/11th of a second, a split second. So if by a split second's association you can attain all success, spiritual life, how does that work? I mean, I just happen to glance Srila Prabhupada or a pure devotee and now I'm in my life is successful? Or what does it actually mean? So this topic came up whilst we were in Mayapur in 1976. We were on a morning walk. By that time, all the devotees that are arrived here, there was about 600 devotees that came from overseas, and all the GBCs were there. So one of them, Pancha Dravida Swami, on the morning walk, he wanted to know how a person can attain perfection simply from one lava or 1/11th of a second's association with the pure. But stopped, and he turned to him as we all gathered around. He said that it is like dry wood, which can be ignited immediately. Similarly, if one is sincere, then he immediately becomes spiritually ignited. And if he is still moist from material contact, then it may take hundreds of years or lifetimes. A pure devotee, he said, is like a match, and the recipient is the wood. If both the wood and the match are good, then there is fire. He told us, when you go to the fire, you become dry. But this nonsense business makes us wet. So this process is already there, how to become dry. But instead of taking the process, we again put water. Then how will it be ignited? So the rules and regulations are following the rules and regulation. If you again become victimized by Maya, then there is water, and again you have to dry it. So this is going on, watering and drying, watering and drying. So the difficulty is that we dry, and then again we put water. So, yes, it's back home, back to Godhead, even if we spent millions of births in this material world, that can be all ended very quickly by the right association. But it's not a one-way street. Yeah, it's two-way. It's reciprocal. That's what Krishna consciousness is all about. Krishna prema, love, of giving oneself to the beloved. And then the beloved also reciprocates and gives himself to the lover. So it's a two-way thing. It's not that Krishna does everything and we don't do anything. Nor is it like the Karma Mimamsa philosophy that whatever we do, we're bound to get the reaction for that. And it doesn't matter whether there's a God or not. It's automatic, you know, like way either. Actually, in one of the Vaishnava Sampradayas, there was a big argument that developed about how one gets salvation. And one side was arguing that it's just by doing pious works. And when you do your pious works, then just on that principle, you'll get free of material life. And then the other side was arguing, no, it's just by the mercy of God. Yeah, without the mercy of God, you can't get free of the material world. Nothing else is required. No matter what we do, what works we perform, it doesn't count for anything. It's just the mercy of God. So this way they were arguing. And the examples were given of the monkey and the cat. Yeah. So on one side, they were arguing the mercy of God, that's like the cat. When the cat gets the kitten, she picks it up by the scruff of the neck and carries it here and there. The kitten doesn't have to do anything. And then on the other side, the monkey, see the little monkeys, they grab hold of the mother and they hang on for dear life. So it's up to them. If they let go, they fall. Yeah, the mother monkey's jumping from branch to branch, going high. The little monkey's hanging on, and that way they get transported. So actually, because of that argument, that sampradaya split. And still to this day, after hundreds of years, that argument is still going on. They haven't resolved it. But in Chaitanya Mahaprabhu's movement, the resolution is given here that it's reciprocal. And that example is of the man in the well. If you fall in a well, you can't get out on your own. Somebody has to come, you have to call. Somebody comes, they throw down a rope. So if he doesn't throw the rope down, you won't get out. But if you don't hang on to the rope, you won't get out either. So the rope has to be there and you have to hang on to it. So both things have to be there. Both things have to be good. So you have to find a genuine sadhu, a genuine devotee. He can give you the instruction. But you have to take it. We have to apply it in our lives. It's not, it won't do any good just to sit and listen and smile and then go away and go back to doing all nonsense. One has to actually take it seriously and practice. So in this way then, it takes, as they say in the West, it takes two to tango, or it takes two to do kirtan. So during the same walk, then one of the devotees, Vishnu Jan Swami, who is the tall, charismatic co-leader of the Radha Damodar Traveling Sankirtan Party, who was listening in the background, spoke up for the first time. He asked Srila Prabhupada, how did Chota Haridas achieve perfection by killing himself after apparently pouring water, means, you know, doing something material, on his devotional creeper by talking to a woman? He was referring to the close associate of Lord Chaitanya who had drowned himself in the Ganga after being rejected by the Lord. Prabhupada's reply was very grave. His instance was that even an associate of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu can fall down. And if one falls down, his punishment is this: suicide. There is no other punishment. He must commit suicide. So that is Chaitanya Mahaprabhu's instruction. Otherwise, he was Chaitanya Mahaprabhu's personal servant, so he cannot fall down. But Chaitanya Mahaprabhu showed in this instance that even if one is my personal servant, he can fall down. And if anyone, by any cause, he falls down, his punishment is that he must commit suicide. This is the instruction. Everybody's eyes widened as they took in the statement. And then Prabhupada elaborated. So this fall down, there is a possibility at any moment, because we are very small, we can be captivated by Maya at any moment. Therefore, we shall be very, very careful. And if you fall down, then the punishment is that you make suicide. We shall see. So Vishnu Jan Maharaj withdrew to the back as the other sannyasis sought clarification. Satsvarup mentioned that in the Nectar of Devotion, it says that devotional service is so pure that there is no prayaschitta, or atonement, if one falls down. We just again... So Prabhupada agreed, but he said that Chota Haridas's case was not typical. He was an exemplary punishment that was enacted between him and Lord Chaitanya. Chaitanya Mahaprabhu was Vajrad Apikotara, harder than a thunderbolt and softer than a rose. But Prabhupada is strict as that. No, I am not Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. I am not. Why are you comparing me? I am an ordinary man, Prabhupada said. Guru Kripa Maharaj brought the exchange to its point, asking the question that was undoubtedly on everybody's mind. So in ISKCON, if somebody falls down, does it mean that he should commit suicide? Prabhupada's monosyllabic answer could not be clearer. No. Grew much of a movement then. Bit of reality there. Prabhupada clarified, no, if he falls down, that is automatically suicide. If he falls down, that means it is suicide. He got the chance, and if he ritual suicide. If one gets the chance of becoming eligible to go back home, back to Godhead, and if he commits a mistake and it's stopped, is that not suicide? He concluded that we should be very strong-minded and continue our devotional service with determination. As a side point there, Vishnu Jan Maharaj, that was the last festival that he attended. And in fact, that was the last time that we saw him. It was on that morning walk. He had read something in the Chaitanya Charitamrita about Chota Haridas. And something was in his mind. He came to the Fathpad, this question, is this the proper way to deal with the fall down? And of course, Prabhupada had said yes. So he heard what he wanted to hear. When the conversation continued on, he kind of moved to the back. And he was a little bit kind of detached and aloof. After a few days, Nobodal, on the, I think the 20th of March, just before Prabhupada was leaving to go to Calcutta and then to Delhi and Vrindavan for the second half of the festival, then Tamal Krishna Maharaj came. Vishnu Jan Swami has not been seen for 3 or 4 days. Nobody knows where he is. So he was naturally very concerned. Vishnu Jan Swami was one of the most charismatic personalities in ISKCON. He was known for his wonderful kirtans. He had a very deep understanding of Krishna consciousness, and he was able to convey that in a very simple way that anybody could understand it but would be deeply impressed with it. So he was the much of this Radha Damodar traveling Sankirtan party. And of course, at that point, they had about 100 brahmacharis that were living on 7 Greyhound buses, and they were touring all over America. They were selling at least $50,000 worth of books, $50,000 a month to the BBT. They were selling tens of thousands of Back to Godheads, 10 or 20,000 big books every month, and, you know, practically unlimited small books. So he was in a very important position. As it happened, at that festival all been removed as the head of the Radha Damodar. He was being sent to China. And so now all of a sudden the other leader of the party disappears. Nobody saw him again. So it was a big concern. But unusually, Srila Prabhupada didn't react. When Tamal Krishna Maharaj told Srila Prabhupada, Vishnu Jan Swami has disappeared, Prabhupada said, okay, so maybe he just doesn't want to serve. That it was a very muted response. I was surprised. Tamal Krishna Maharaj was surprised. I remember talking with him afterwards, some months afterwards, and he told me, yeah, he said, I couldn't understand Prabhupada's response to that. So after a couple of months, we left India in April. We went on what was Prabhupada's last world tour. At the beginning of June, we arrived in Los Angeles. So Tamal Krishna Maharaj was there to greet Srila Prabhupada. And again, he brought up this topic. So by this time, March, April, May, June. So at least 3 months had gone by. And he mentioned to Srila Prabhupada that still nobody has seen Vishnu Jan Swami. It's just like he's just evaporated. And he pointed out that generally when a person leaves, at least in those days when a person left ISKCON, somebody would spot them somewhere. Yeah, they'd take up their ordinary activities again, but somebody would see them somewhere. It was highly unlikely that they would just disappear for good. So, and especially somebody that was as well known as Vishnu Jan. So because he hadn't been seen anymore, Tamal Krishna again brought it up. And this time he hinted, or he said that there was some talk that perhaps he had committed suicide. Now, I don't know whether he was remembering this conversation on the roof and was kind of joining the dots, so to speak, and came to the idea that he probably, because he had asked about this incident with Chota Haridas, that maybe he'd had some personal problem and therefore he decided to commit suicide as the best way to rectify it. Maybe it came from other people, I don't know. But that was the question. So when he put it to Srila Prabhupada that, you know, there's some talk that he's committed suicide, Prabhupada, he was doubtful. He said, I don't think so. So anyway, they left it at that. When Tamal went out, I asked Prabhupada a question or two myself about it. And I said, but how could he go without not being spotted? So then Prabhupada said, what is that? He said, any sannyasi, you can go anywhere in India, any village, and they'll immediately give you something to eat, something to drink. You can go, you know, he could be touring anywhere in India in the villages, you wouldn't see him. So he said, I'm not convinced. So that was it. There was no more talk about him until the following year. So in April of 77, by that time, I had left Srila Prabhupada's party. He sent me back to Australia. Tamal Krishna Maharaj had come on as Prabhupada's permanent secretary. And so one of our devotees, Petit Udaran, or Petit Pavan, the astrologer, he was in India. So he had been touring around, and I think he went to Allahabad. And then when he was there, he heard some stories from some of the local people that one tall Western sadhu had hired a boat. He had gone out into the middle of the Ganges, and he had a big rock that he tied around his neck, and he jumped in the river, and that was it. He was gone. So two or three people told him that. So, and then he reported that to Tamal Krishna Maharaj. I think that might have been Vishnu Jan. So he's told that to Srila Prabhupada. And because Vishnu Jan had not been seen for at least a year, then Prabhupada said, all right, then it does appear that he's done that. He's committed suicide. So he said, that's good. He was a sannyasi, so he said, that's good. So then Tamal Krishna Maharaj asked him, then what would be his fate? Because we read that if somebody commits suicide, they become a ghost. If you get into such a state of ignorance that you no longer want to live, you want to end your existence, of course you can't do that, but because people identify with the body and they want to reject that body, they want to, you know, give up living, sometime they become a ghost. So is that the fate for somebody that's done Krishna conscious activities, and especially somebody like Vishnu Jan? So that question was asked, and Prabhupada said, he's in the heavenly planets preaching. So there's no loss in Krishna consciousness. Whatever we do, that helps. I know there was one young man joined, and he was always having problems. He wanted to be a devotee. He was kind of sincere. But at the same time, he was struggling to control his senses, and he kept falling down. So eventually he became so much in despair that he killed himself, to Srila Prabhupada. And he replied, okay, but because he did devotional service, he'll take another human birth and it'll again continue. He will not become a ghost. So like that. The power of devotional service is insurmountable. Anyway, so that's just a side issue about Vishnu Jan Pad was making, that we should be very careful about following the principles and practicing our devotional life, because anybody, even if they're an associate of Lord Chaitanya, they can fall down, because the material nature is all-powerful and all-pervasive. So it's lotus feet. At any moment, Maya can pick us off. Any little weakness, as we say, any chink in the armor, she'll penetrate. She'll find out what is our personal interest, our selfish consciousness, and she'll expose it. So we have to simply surrender to Lord Chaitanya, depend on his lotus feet, and chant the Hare Krishna mantra. Prabhupada said that will save us from Maya. So, left to Gaur Purnima, we went to Calcutta. Then from there we went to New Delhi. We had a few programs. We were staying at the house of Lakshman Agarwal, who was the owner of the Lakshman Sylvania Light Bulb Company. He had a house there, big house, in Chanakyapuri. So we did a couple of days pandals there. Then we went to Modi Naga. We were staying at the house of Mrs. Modi. We did a pandal program, because they have a Lakshmi Narayan temple there, quite a nice one, and we did a program there. Then from there, Prabhupada went to a gentleman there, Surendra Kumar Saigal, who owned the Tiger Lock Company. So he also invited Prabhupada to do a pandal. And then we came to Vrindavan. So anyway, whilst we were in Delhi, regular schedule, every morning at the crack of dawn, he would go out and he would walk. So a few devotees had come. They were staying just nearby, Lakshman Agarwal's house. And Gurudas Maharaj was there. Pushkar Swami had just become Prabhupada's personal secretary. March 25th in 1976 in Delhi, there was some discussion about independence and how much independence does an individual soul actually have. Some people argue that we don't have any independence whatsoever. Some people argue if you go to many astrologers, they'll tell you, no, it's your choice. You have a little independence. Your destiny is in your hands. You know, we all hear these things. So people get confused, you know. Are we just simply subjected to our karma and we're helpless? Or do we actually have, we can redirect ourselves? You know, you always hear this from these so-called self-help programs. You know, determine your own fate. Don't be a victim. You become what you want to become. You know, chant this mantra every morning. You know, I am the best. I will succeed in my business. If you chant this affirmation every day, you're bound to become successful. You create your own fortune, blah, blah, blah. So what is the actual situation? So Pushkar Swami pursued the point. If a person is habituated to smoking, he said, is he free in that activity or has he surrendered his freedom? So Prabhupada said that it's like a person who smokes despite the government printing a warning on the box. One is free to do it, but he is not freed from the results. Therefore, the living entity has minute but not absolute independence. It's like a child who is free to play, but as soon as he does something wrong, his father is there to correct him. Pushkar Swami again took it further, wanting more clarification. So this idea of freedom and independence, he said, is it possible for anyone, theoretically, to surrender to Krishna at any time? Prabhupada said, yes. So let's say that somebody is in a very degraded condition of life, in the modes of ignorance and passion. So his mind is always disturbed. So in surrendering to Krishna, is it possible that he can be independent even of his mind? That reminds me, just as an example of how a person can be really in the modes of ignorance. In North Sydney, where we have our temple there in Australia, there was one character that used to wander in the streets. He was a tramp, or in America they call them bums. Yeah. So this man, he was so much in the mode of ignorance, he would never wash, ever. He wore the same clothes. You see them sometimes, crazy people. They never, ever wash. They're filthy, dirty. He passed stool in his pants. He would never clean himself. His hair was grown out. It was all thick and matted with dirt and filth. And he would sit on a bench in the street, right in the middle of one of the main shopping, you know, upscale shopping areas of North Sydney. And he would simply sit there and people couldn't go anywhere near him because he smelt so bad. And that's what all he would do. Somehow or another he would get it together to eat, because you never forget that, you know. Even if you're in the grossest ignorance, you still find something to eat. But apart from that, he would never talk with anybody. Anybody that tried to help him, he would refuse. Head down. All the time. That was his continuous state of, you know, ignorance. He had his head down, hiding. He didn't want to communicate or even recognize his own existence practically. So one day, he collapsed. So one of the local traders actually was the guy that ran the local pub. So he saw him. He was collapsed in the street. So out of compassion, he took him into his place. They washed him off. They burnt all his clothes. They cut all his hair off. And they cleaned him up. They scrubbed him up so that he looked, you know, normal again. And he was still unconscious when they did that. So when he woke up, he was lying in a nice bed, clean, nice atmosphere, you know. And when he woke up, he thought that he had died and gone to heaven. And then he became very angry. why you clean me up? What have you done? And within a couple of months, he was out, you know, on the street again in the same filthy, horrible, stinking condition. So, you know, this is the mode of ignorance. This is the mind. Yeah? He chose to be in the mode. So Pushyakrishna's, you know, question was very good. What about somebody that's really in the modes of ignorance and passion? You know, their mind is completely disturbed. Can they also surrender to Krishna? And Prabhupada said yes. So he said, well, you know, is it possible that he can be independent of the mind? And Prabhupada said, you are independent of the mind always. It is your mind. You are not the mind. So then you're independent. So Pushyakrishna said, even a person then merged in the mode of ignorance can by some good fortune surrender to Krishna. Not good fortune, Prabhupada said. God, Krishna, he says, you do it here, and immediately you become fortunate. There's no question of waiting to become fortunate. Sometimes we also hear that, you know, when we're out preaching, you try to convince somebody to take up Krishna consciousness or to chant Hare Krishna, and they say, when God desires, when Krishna desires with it. So Prabhupada's point was, no, you don't have to wait to become fortunate. No question of waiting. You become fortunate immediately. So suppose if I say, take this bag, $100,000. So you can take it. Immediately you become a rich man. So why don't you take it? Understanding Prabhupada's point on the mercy of the Lord, Gurudas Maharaj asked, how does Kripa Siddhi work? Prabhupada's reaction took us all by surprise. Kripa Siddhi means that you are not willing to take this bag of money, and I say, take it, take it, take it. And he suddenly turned and very vigorously pushed Gurudas in the stomach as if he were trying to give it. Everybody broke out laughing, and Gurudas Maharaj was simultaneously astonished and delighted at the sudden abrogation of the formal guru-disciple relationship. Prabhupada continued the mimicry and the pushing. He was pushing him in the, because Gurudas was a little big, so he's pushing him in the stomach. Prabhupada himself feigned resistance. No. And then again he began pushing. Take it, take it. So he said, this is Kripa Siddhi. Even if you were unwilling, I give it in your pocket. I push it. That is Kripa Siddhi. So there's nothing dry in Prabhupada's expression of philosophy. It makes the philosophy come alive. In doing so, he attracts us to use our little independence to surrender to his lotus feet. Gurudas mentioned that since we see everyone in the world as potential devotees, so we should also serve them so that they can become devotees. But Prabhupada clarified the distinction between showing mercy and serving others. That is not service, Prabhupada said. That is mercy. He explained that although a devotee has a mood of service, Vaishnava philosophy, and we show mercy to the lower ones. He said that the popular Mayavadi idea that we should serve everyone is wrong. It's not service, that service to man. What to speak about service to man is service to God, which is another aspect. But just doing service to others, it's wrong. It's showing the mercy. So this Astra, that the most advanced devotee sees himself as being the lowest of all. So I said that if that is so, then where's the question of an advanced devotee showing mercy to somebody who he sees as being lower? Because he doesn't see anybody as being lower. Prabhupada replied that the advanced devotee doesn't see anybody. His mood is one of sympathy. Oh, here is a person. He can become a devotee. Let me raise him to the standard. So he concluded, it is duty. It does not mean that he's thinking, oh, I am higher. No. So Pushyakrishna added, in other words, he doesn't consider that he is advanced and therefore, that's correct, Prabhupada said. He is always thinking, I am lower than the worm, but Lord Krishna wants it, so let me do that service. That's not service to the person, that's service to Krishna. You serve Krishna, you show Krishna's mercy to others. That's all. Prabhupada's comments made it clear that it's simply a question of offering assistance to help another person to advance. Prabhupada illustrated his point through another comical exchange with Gurudas. Therefore we say Prabhu. Prabhu means, you are my master, please order me, what can I do for you? That should be the attitude, not Gurudas Prabhu, please come here and brush my shoes. So sometimes we see that mood, Prabhu, do this. You're ordering, but you're using Prabhu. No, Prabhupada explained, it should be very humble. So you ask them. So we all laughed again, perhaps recognizing something of ourselves in the parody. As Prabhupada continued, what kind of Prabhu? He should say, Gurudas Prabhu, can I brush your shoes? That is a Vaishnav. So that reminded me of a story that one of my friends told me when I was very small. I think we were about 8 or 9 years old. I was brought up in an industrial town in northern England. And at that time, in the 1950s, practically speaking, there was very few Indians or Asians, at least in our part of the country. I had, at 8 or 9 years old, I had never seen anybody from India. I'd never seen in real life, at least, anybody who wasn't white. You know, I'd never seen anybody that was colored or black. So my best friend, he was living up in the town, and then all of a sudden an Indian family moved in next door. So they were, surprised. They'd never seen anybody from India before. And just to help them adjust, his father told him a story. So he said that during the war, because in the British Army there were many Indian troops, and there was, I think, nearly up to 2 million Indian troops in the British Army fighting in Europe. So still at that time, of course, India was under British occupation. It wasn't independent. So the tendency of the British troops was to see the Indian troops as being lesser beings. And they would treat them sometimes very contemptuously, even though, they were risking their lives just the same as they were and fighting for the same cause. So that prejudice was there, the white man's burden, and we have to change the Indians and make them civilized by becoming British. That mentality was there in the Raj. It was kind of very deep-seated. So one man in their regiment, a British soldier, he was treating an Indian soldier with, real contempt. He would shout at him, he would push him around, and he would generally verbally abuse him. So one morning, he woke up and he went to put his boots on, because the first thing in the army that they do is they keep them, always engaged. So one of the things they have to do is to shine the brass buckles and, brush their boots, keep them highly polished, keep all their equipment clean and like that. So it's a bit of a chore. Nobody likes to do it. So this man got up and he went to get his boots and they were already polished. They were nice and shiny. So he was surprised. Who's polished my boots? So then this Indian soldier came forward, the one that he'd been abusing, and he said, I did it. And he was very humble about it. So immediately, my friend's father said, this man started to cry, the British soldier, when he saw the humility of this other soldier, Indian soldier. Immediately he softened up and he began to cry. And then after that, they became best friends. So that's a good example, as Prabhupada's saying here, that if you humbly execute your devotional service, Prabhu, can I do something for you? Then that's your ticket back to Godhead. Okay, so that's a few things about Sadhu Sangha. Any questions up to this point? Or comments? Okay, so we'll push on. Another aspect, of course, for us, Prabhupada's association was the key. First went to America, of course, nobody knew anything. The early devotees, they'd practically never heard of Krishna. They didn't know anything about Indian culture or Vedic culture. And practically speaking, they joined Krishna consciousness on the basis of their personal association with Srila Prabhupada, because of his character, because of his knowledge, etc. So, of course, as ISKCON spread, it wasn't always possible to personally associate with Prabhupada anymore. I know in Australia when I joined in 1972, we would see Srila Prabhupada 1 week a year. And we were lucky, actually. Prabhupada came the first time in 1971, and he came every year for 1 week. There were many places in the world where we had temples that Prabhupada had never, ever visited. So it wasn't easy to get Prabhupada's association. But the Mayapur festival, that was the place when hundreds or thousands of devotees could come and they would get extended association with Prabhupada. So as much as, you know, we started coming to Mayapur and Vrindavan so that we could visit the dhams, you know, we had heard about Vrindavan Dham. After 1974, when Prabhupada gave the instruction that all the temple presidents and as many devotees as possible from all the temples should attend the Gopunima festival in Mayapur and Vrindavan, then lots of devotees started going over and we were very excited, you know, that we were coming to the dhams, India for that matter. I had never been to India before, and the first time I came was in 1975 for the Gopunima festival. So it was a very wonderful experience. But the essence of it was the fact that Prabhupada was going to be there. And the whole festival was centered around Srila Prabhupada's attendance, his giving class, and to have darshans in the afternoon in his rooms. So on February the 28th, 1976, then we were in Mayapur, and devotees were just starting to arrive for the festival. An increasing number of devotees are discovering the sweetness of evening darshans in Prabhupada's room. The devotees read with Srila Prabhupada in such an informal and intimate setting. Prabhupada has been responding to their eagerness with some blissful recollections of his early days in America in 1965 and 66. Went through. This evening, he told us that when he came to America, he had not expected to remain for very long because his original visa was only for 2 months. But for a year, he continued to extend his stay. 2 months, 2 months, 2 months. And each time thinking to remain a little longer and give things a try. But sometimes he would go to the shipping agency and inquire, when is the next ship going back to America? Actually go. Eventually, the clerk, a friendly Indian man, inquired, Swamiji, you're always asking, but actually, when will you go? And Prabhupada would laugh and tell him, no, actually, I don't want to go, but sometimes when I become a little disappointed, I think about it. So that was the situation. A long time, Prabhupada was on his own, and nothing really very much was happening. And really, the movement didn't start until June or July of 66, when Prabhupada got 26 Second Avenue. Then things at that point started to develop. So in the meantime, Prabhupada was more or less just wandering around on his own. He's loitering in the street. He said, you were also loitering in the street. So he gave the example of the man who is a musician. In one place he finds a gourd and in a squash gourd. And in another place he finds a piece of wire. And in another place he finds a bit of wood. And then he puts them all together and he made a nice instrument. So he said, in the same way, I was loitering here and there, you were loitering here and there. And alone we couldn't do anything, but together now we're making nice music. So, back to the meeting there. Then as preaching opportunities started to unfold, Prabhupada said, he began to pay a lawyer $150 a month to get his visa extended. Then eventually, he took a man's advice. He left America and went to Montreal to apply for residence from there. And then after 3 months, he was able to re-enter the country with his green card, and he came to Santa Fe in New Mexico, where Subaldas had started a center. Prabhupada went on to tell us about his life in New York's Second Avenue. He would stroll along the riverbank, the Hudson River, unaware that the area was notoriously dangerous. Eventually, somebody informed him that sometimes snipers were shooting the pedestrians there. He said, I was innocent. He said, I didn't know that they were killing people there. So he was just walking along. And sometimes Prabhupada said also he would get on a bus. He had no idea where it was going to. He would just get on the bus and travel on the bus to the end and come back just to see, you know, New York. And he would observe all the American people, how they were living. He would look and see what the culture was, and he would be trying to think how to communicate Krishna consciousness to them and preach effectively. So it was fascinating to listen to him reminiscing about the early days of his mission. Never self-laudatory, Prabhupada is always humble about his success. He captivates his audience with his unique and remarkable character. He has a combination of youthful simplicity coupled with an astonishingly deep perceptiveness of human nature and life in general. He attributes everything to Lord Krishna's special mercy rather than to any expertise of his own. This selfless quality makes him irresistibly attractive and an ideal teacher and our most trustworthy friend. So it was very nice every evening. Everybody would gather in Prabhupada's rooms there in the Lotus Building in Mayapur. Be a nice breeze blowing through. Every night the lights would go out. The electricity would be on and off all the time. And we would have these kerosene lamps. We would light them, put one on either side of Srila Prabhupada. And it was very nice just to sit there in this kind of soft glow and watch as Prabhupada recounted his preaching activities. So from then, as I said, the festival began to build up. By March the 11th, there were over 600 devotees that were visiting. About 300 or 400 had come from America, and then from Europe, from Australia, etc. So March the 11th then was the official beginning of the festival. Just before the class started, Prabhupada gave the hundreds of assembled devotees his personal welcome. His simple, heartfelt message expressing his appreciation for their attendance here in Mayapur was greeted with loud cheers and smiles. First of all, he said, we must welcome all the devotees. There may be so many inconveniences. Please do not mind it. This is Chaitanya Mahaprabhu's place. Be joyful always. Thank you. So there wasn't that much facility there in Mayapur in those days. Everything was under construction. And a lot of devotees, you know, were kind of staying in those rooms on the front wall there. There was no water. There were no proper toilets, just holes in the ground. And that pukur that's just in front of Prabhupada's samadhi, that had just been dug, but it was just mud. So every morning we were going out and either, you know, get a bucket under the hand pumps, or we would jump into the pukur and wash in there. But and practically speaking, everybody in those days that came, you would immediately get dysentery because we weren't used to the food and everything. And we weren't careful either. I remember in 1975 that I wasn't, of course, Prabhupada's servant at that time. But, you know, we were there. We were staying in the rooms on the front wall. I was staying in the room exactly next to Prabhupada's Bhajan Kutia. Everything was just cement and bricks. There was no doors even on the room, but that's where we were staying. And onto the road outside. Again, there was not a single shop there. There was not a single vendor. It was completely peaceful and open. It was very nice. Not like now. But there was one little boy there, and he had one of these ice boxes. You know, they hang them around their necks. And he had some ice, homemade ice, being very lusty. It was getting hot, and I thought, oh, great, I'll get an ice lolly. So I bought two. And as I ate them, as they were going down, I could feel all the little germs and bacteria jumping around in joy. Harry Ball. As soon as it hit my stomach, I was finished. I was on my back. Extreme stomach pains. I had dysentery for 8 days. I couldn't move. I mean, that's the way it was in those days. Everybody got sick. It's not like that nowadays, thank goodness. So anyway, as Prabhupada knew very well, there were some inconveniences for the devotees. So he said, don't mind it. This is Chaitanya Mahaprabhu's place. So that made up for everything. It was worth all the problems just to be there in the Dham. But of course, to be there with Srila Prabhupada, that was even more so. So his thoughtfulness immeasurably deepened everybody to him. Without Srila Prabhupada, none of us would be here. None of us would have even heard of Mayapur or Krishna consciousness or tasted the happiness of spiritual life. So his humble concern about the lack of amenities was all the more endearing. As he had told us earlier on his morning walk, it was that he had built a guest house first, even before he built the temple. So that was his plan from 1972. You'll see, I think they're on the trvp.org website, 72, of Srila Prabhupada in the Calcutta temple. And next to him, there is a model of what he was planning to build in Mayapur. So there was like a pyramid-shaped temple. It was going to be 100 feet high. And then there were four buildings at the back. The temple was nearest the road, and there were four buildings at the back. And they were... So instead of building the temple first, Prabhupada built the first of what was going to be four guest facilities, and that was the Lotus Building. And then as soon as that was ready, the devotees moved in, and the deities, Radha Madhav, the small brass deities, they were installed on the ground floor of that building. So some were doing that. But Prabhupada told us that wherever there are devotees, then God will come there. Krishna is not a dull stone. He is drawn by the affection of his devotees. Therefore, making a place for God without the facility for his devotees is simply idol worship. So he said, I did this on purpose. First of all, let the devotees come. Then we shall build a wonderful temple for Radha Madhav. Radha Madhav are very happy because so many devotees are here. So they don't mind that we build a building for them first. So that's the mood of later, March the 14th, just before Gopurnima Day. So down in the temple room during his discourse, Prabhupada told us about bhava or ecstasy. At the present moment, he said, we've got a bhava. I am this, I am that, I belong to this family, I belong to this nation. So bhava is ecstasy, and everybody is overwhelmed with such kinds of ecstasy. So these politicians, they think that we, devotees, are simply wasting our time in chanting and dancing. Oh, they have no sense how to improve the condition of the country. So they do not like it because they're in a different bhava. But we are trying to change that bhava. The bhava must be there, and the whole Krishna consciousness movement is how to purify the bhava. That is stated here in this verse. Parishuddha bhavaha. So we are not negating anything. We are simply changing from material bhava to spiritual bhava. That's all. So here is a big building. Means the Lotus Building. But there are many hundreds and thousands of big buildings in this district or in this country. But here, the bhava is changed. In your country, there are many big skyscraper buildings. Means mainly America. In comparison to those buildings, this building is nothing. But still you have come, spending thousands of dollars here to change your bhava. So that is required. Otherwise, you American boys and girls, you have no business to come here and see this big building. No. But to change the bhava, that is the important thing that is required. So he finished his class. Prabhupada got down from his Vyasasan, and the devotees crowded around. And then Prabhupada embarked on his daily circuit of the temple room. So this became a tradition at that festival. Prabhupada circumambulating the deities. And on either side of the deity room, there were bells hanging from the ceiling. So as Prabhupada started to walk around, he would stop under the bell. He would take the rope and he would start banging the bell very loudly. Jai Shri Shri Radha Shyama Sundara, is it? Radha Shyama. Radha Gopinath, sorry. Well, Shyamasunda Gopinath, same person. So the devotees, you know, they would all be chanting. There literally was several hundred devotees following Srila Prabhupada around. And the more times he went round, the more the kirtan increased, the more he stopped and pulled the ropes on the bells and rang the bells, the more the devotees would jump up and down. The more they jumped up and down, the harder Prabhupada would ring the bells. So like this, the whole thing was building up and building up. So it was very wonderful. So the devotees were wild with delight as Prabhupada rang the bells hanging down on either side of the temple room, strongly pulling on the ropes for prolonged spells, encouraging the devotees to chant and dance with increasing enthusiasm and smiling all the while. After his third circuit, he came before their lordships and he began to dance. Hundreds of devotees converged around him, leaping with excitement as he put first one hand in the air and then, handing his cane to Madhavisa Swami, he raised the other. With both arms extended and a huge smile on his face, he urged the ecstatic crowd to greater and greater heights of spiritual abandon as he also jumped up and down enthusiastically. It was a personal demonstration of what Lord Chaitanya's festival is really all about, purification through association. Visiting the Dham is wonderful, but seeing and being with Srila Prabhupada is the concentrated essence. So that was really wonderful. Each morning we would go through, you know, this bell ringing and circumambulation of the deities. It was, you know, some of the devotees, I mean, they never experienced anything like it. We had, none of us had actually. The Prabhupada jumping up and down and smiling and just, you know, as much as you could jump in the air and chant loudly, Prabhupada was encouraging like this. It was very, really wonderful. So as I said, from there, Mayapur, we went over to the Delhi side and Vrindavan. And then by April the 10th, that was the last day of the festival. And then from there, all the devotees would be going back. So all the devotees are visibly surcharged from their association with Srila Prabhupada during the last few weeks. Now they'll all be returning to their respective temples to push on the Sankirtan movement. As Prabhupada has stated many times, his idea is to bring as many devotees as possible to the Mayapur Vrindavan Gaupurnima festival. He knows that they will be with the Dhams, and thus they will return fully enthused with spiritual potency to preach for another year. So that was Prabhupada's plan. From 1967 onwards, Prabhupada had been talking about getting what he called originally an American house in Vrindavan. He was looking for land in the early or the late. A few others had left America to avoid the draft, the Vietnam War draft. They came to India and they were staying here and there in different temples of Prabhupada's God Brothers. But Prabhupada was already writing to them, you try and get some land in Mayapur. So right from the beginning, Prabhupada fortunate souls as he could to Vrindavan and Mayapur and have the actual experience of living in the place of Krishna and Lord Chaitanya's pastimes. Of course, he did that on a big scale more and more as he got more following and he got more facility. He was able to increase and, you know, build up his plans. He knows that it's of course it is Srila Prabhupada's association which is our chief motivating principle. We may not know Krishna, but Srila Prabhupada is in our midst, and it is due to the strong, reciprocal, loving relationship with him that all of the devotees are working so hard year after. We just needed a bit of encouragement from Srila Prabhupada. We could go out all year long. Yeah, whenever Prabhupada came to Australia for that 1 week, then after he left, everybody would be completely spiritually surcharged for the rest of the year. That boost, you know, would keep us going. So Prabhupada had that plan. And in Mayapur especially, of course, Lord Chaitanya's birthplace, he wanted something very grand to be built there. We're doing that now. But in 1973, late 73, building was nearing completion. Then he thought, now I have the facility, I can bring as many devotees as possible. So he sent a letter out to instruct that all the temple presidents and as many devotees as possible should come to Mayapur every year. And so we started doing that. Really from 74 onwards, that was when the Mayapur festival started to take off. In 1976, Prabhupada sent me out on Gopunima day to just have a look and see how many people were coming through the front gates. The police estimate was that about 1 lakh of people came on Gopunima day that year, which was, you know, amazing. Previously, hardly anybody would go into the Mayapur area. Later on, when we see the slideshow, I'll show you a map of Mayapur from 1917-1918. Yeah, there's nothing there. It's just land, that's all. So even, you know, Prabhupada's god brothers had their temples there. The yog pit was there. But practically speaking, before ISKCON, nobody used to go on that side of the river. Everybody would go to Navadweep, but they would not come to the other side. After ISKCON started up in Mayapur area there, very quickly, people started coming. So by 1976, 1 lakh of people turned up by estimate for Gopunima Day. Of course, now we have 5 lakhs, 10 lakhs. It's hard to say exactly how many people come over there. So Prabhupada had his plan, both for purifying us and for advertising the glories of the Dharma. So in 1977, Rameshwara Swami came to see Srila Prabhupada when he arrived from America. That was also very interesting. About 300 devotees came from America that year. They all came on one aeroplane, and it was the first jumbo jet, 747, to land in Calcutta. It was like a PR coup. Yeah, they found out somehow or another. The Calcutta airport, of course, was way behind everywhere else. So they would not allow jumbo jets to land in Calcutta because the runways were so small and in poor condition. So they, you know, increased it so that they could get more international visitors. And in early 1977, they announced that the first jumbo jet will arrive in Calcutta in February. So our devotees, they found out which aeroplane it was. And they booked all the seats on that one aeroplane. And then they all got on board in New York. It set out from New York. It came to Europe. They picked up more devotees in Europe. And then when they landed in Calcutta, then all the TV were there. The chief minister was there. You know, all the newspapers were there to greet the first jumbo jet into Calcutta. Now we're advancing. The door opens and 300 or 400 devotees. They were all surprised. But of course, they had to greet them. They had garlands and everything. So it's very nice. So anyway, Rameshwara was with them. He came to see Srila Prabhupada. And he was a bit concerned because, you know, he was the BBT trustee in America. At that time, the American BBT was huge. Millions of dollars were coming in. Millions of books were going out. And so he was a bit concerned because every year during the Gopunima time, everything came to a stop. Most of the devotees that came over to Mayapur were actually the Sankirtan devotees. So that meant, you know, first of all, he calculated each devotee would spend at least $1,000 on their tickets. So 350 devotees, that's $350,000 just for this one trip. And then when they arrived, they would have to spend at least a couple of $100 each. That's so many thousands more. And then also in America, practically there was no more book distribution for at least 6 weeks. They would come, say, for 1 month. So whilst they were there, you know, the temples were just on a kind of bare maintenance mode. No book distribution was going on. So that meant there was a huge drop in book distribution. Not only that, there was a huge drop then in the money that was sent to the BBT for printing the new books. So like this, he made these calculations that we're losing about $750,000 just on this one festival. They come for a month, even when they go back to America, it takes a couple of weeks to get settled down again and get back into the routine of Sankirtan. So he said that, you know, obviously we want to keep up the income of the BBT. We want to keep up the number of books that are going out. So he was speaking in such a way that he thought, he was convinced that Prabhupada would agree. Yes, we can't stop the book distribution. Yes, we must keep the money coming into the BBT for the new publications. So he made a suggestion. Prabhupada very patiently heard him out. And he made a suggestion that what we could do is, instead of having all the devotees come every year, we can, you know, split them up. So one third comes one year, the next third comes the next year, the final third comes the third year, and then on the fourth year, the first batch comes back again. So in this way, devotees can come, you know, every 3 years or every 4 years, and we can keep everything going, and we can keep the BBT going very nicely. So Prabhupada heard him out, and he said, no. He said, as many devotees as possible should come every year. So that was his plan. He didn't care about the money, even the fact that the number of books would reduce for that period. He didn't care, because he knew if the devotees came to the Dham, they came to Mayapur, they came to Vrindavan, that's association. By associating with the holy Dham, by associating together, yeah, people from all over the world, you would meet so many new devotees. You know, you never went out of your own country maybe, but at the Mayapur festival you would meet people from all over the world. So it was very enthusing for everybody. And everybody would get purified from being in the Dham. And that was the real point. You know, you're out there all year long in the middle of Maya trying to get a few conditioned souls to get serious about their human lives and take up Krishna consciousness. It's tough. It's not easy. Yeah, here in India, of course, the culture is there. You open up a temple, immediately thousands of people will come. I'm not saying it's easy, but, you know, there's a culture there. And in one sense, you know, like in the West, the Christians have a saying, preaching to the choir. Yeah, preaching to the choir. Every church has a choir. So the choir people are there because they're already convinced. So if you preach to the choir, it doesn't, you know, it's required, but it doesn't take that much effort. But to go out and, you know, pluck somebody from the clutches of ignorance and passion, you know, from nothing, from having no contact, no understanding, no culture, and bring them to Krishna consciousness is not an easy thing. It's tough. Yeah, so if you can get just a few souls to come every year, that's something. So Prabhupada knew it was very tough for the devotees to go out on the street every day selling his books. Sometimes they had to meet very stiff opposition. You know, the deprogrammers, they were going there in 75, 76 from that time onwards. Sometimes they would kidnap the devotees off the street, take them to some, you know, house, and then try to deprogram them. The idea was that they'd been brainwashed, so, you know, you have to bring them back to normal. Force them to drink liquor, force them to eat meat, force them to have sex. You know, so many things that they were doing to break the devotee down and bring him back to normal. So this was the opposition. There's so many things going on, so many difficulties that the devotees had to face. So Prabhupada knew, bring them to Mayapur, bring them to Vrindavan. They'll experience Krishna consciousness as a culture. Yeah, they'll understand. Because sometimes when you're in the West there, it's almost like it's a mental concept. But the material culture is so powerful, so strong, so overwhelming that you feel isolated. And sometimes it feels a bit artificial even to be a devotee in the midst of all of this materialism. Come to Mayapur, come to Vrindavan. Everybody's a devotee. Even the Mohammedans are devotees. Because they don't know it, but they are. Yeah, I mean, in Mayapur, half-hour workers, they're Muslims. Hari Bol, Hare Krishna Prabhu, they all chant. In Vrindavan, my wife, for the last 35, making deity clothing for many temples around the world. She doesn't do it personally, but she supervises it. So the fellow that she works with, Ashok Jariwala, so he has a whole crew of people making deity clothes. They're all Muslims. They're all Muslims, but they're making clothes for the deities. The men used to do all the designs, fabulous designs, and he would really think about how to make beautiful clothing for the deities. They would be every day studying pictures of deities, seeing how the clothing fits, and how to make new decorations. He's a Muslim. So in the Dharma, everybody is a devotee of some kind or another. So you go there, it's the culture. You know, it just absorbed automatically. You don't have to even try practically to think about Krishna and to think about Lord Chaitanya. So Prabhupada wanted us to give, you know, he wanted to give us that opportunity where we could develop our Krishna consciousness to the highest degree. And it was a kind of a, like, in one sense, a reward, I think, you know, for working so hard year after year, that the devotees could come, have a break, and then find out about all the different holy places, see the places of Krishna's and Lord Chaitanya's pastimes. Okay, so that's a little introduction to the seminar on association. It's 10 to 10, so we'll just take a minute to set up. I'll stop at this point. Is there any questions or comments before we move on to the PowerPoint presentation on the research center? Any questions? No? Okay.
Krishna Prabhuji. Hare Krishna Prabhuji. Thank you very much for the wonderful class. You were saying when the discussion was going on between Prabhupada and the devotees that how for a senior, a person does service, the devotee does service, and to the juniors it is his duty and it is not service again. And in that context you said that it's Mayavad to say that it is service to all. So yes. Can you just elaborate on that a little bit?
Well, more? I think the point's fairly clear that according to Rupa Goswami, there are three general classes of devotees. Yeah, there's the Kanistas, there's the Majjhimas, and there's the Uttamas. So a devotee, any devotee, whatever position he's in, he should try to he tries to serve the ones who are more advanced than himself. He associates with those on an equal level, and then he gives mercy to those who are junior or not as advanced. That principle is there. It's a natural principle. And Prabhupada's point was that the idea that we should serve everybody is incorrect. An advanced devotee doesn't serve a junior devotee. He serves somebody more advanced than himself or those who are on equal level. But those who are junior or not as advanced, he shows them mercy. That means that the mood of teaching is there. Yeah, if you're serving, then you can't teach the person that you're serving. The idea of services is that the person is my superior. Yeah? But how then, if you're serving everybody, everybody's superior, how you'll teach them anything? So the idea is it's one of showing mercy. It's a duty. You're serving Krishna. Because Krishna says, nobody is more dear to me than that person who spreads this message of Bhagavad Gita. So Priya Kritama, you know, you become dear to Krishna by spreading these teachings. So that's service to Krishna, but it's mercy to those who are the recipients of your preaching work. And at the same time, you know, we care about other people's advancement. We have to care about our own advancement as well. So that means that we have to find out those devotees who are more advanced than ourselves so that we can serve them and we can receive their mercy. Yeah, and we can receive teachings from them, and then we advance as well. So it's a simultaneous process. We're learning something and we're teaching something. Even one becomes a guru, Prabhupada said, he always remains a disciple. The guru is also always learning. He's teaching, but he's also himself always learning. So that's you know, the relationship there. Is that okay?
All right. Thank you, Prabhupada.
Any other questions? Yes. There's a question over here.
Thank you very much, Prabhuji. Are there any restrictions on number of days that one can stay at Holy Dham according to Srila Prabhupada? Number of days one can stay at Holy Dham.
Is there any restriction on the number of days that you could... Odd question. Yeah. Our idea is Kirtaniya Sadahari. You have to be absorbed in Krishna consciousness 24/7, as they say nowadays, eternally. Right? So the idea is that when you become a pure devotee or pure enough, you're always in Vrindavan. Part of it. Like Srila Prabhupada. Apparently he left Vrindavan. But what was the effect? He created Vrindavan in so many other places around the world. Every place that where Prabhupada went became a place of pilgrimage. It means it became a purified place. Any temple where there's the deity is installed. So that's our ambition, is to live in the Dham forever. We don't want to live in the material world. We want to live in the spiritual world. That's the Dham. So no, there's no restriction. Number of days. You don't count the number of days when you're in Vrindavan. You know, there are no days and nights. There apparently is days and nights in Krishna's Leela, but that's just mood. That's just arrangements that are made to, you know, bring about variety and intensification of the experience of loving Krishna. Actually, there's no day and night. Yeah, it's the spiritual world. It's self-effulgent. How can you have nighttime in a place that's self-effulgent? Yeah, so we count time. We're in the material world. We're conditioned souls. We count the number of minutes, the number of hours. We think that somehow or another there's progress from here to there, from the past to the present to the future. There's not. Nothing changes. Time is eternal. And therefore, in the Brahma Samhita, it's mentioned there that time is noticeable by its absence. Not even the passing of half a second. Nobody notices it. Krishna says, time I am, kalo asmi. So in the material world, when you don't have Krishna, you have time. In the spiritual world, when you do have Krishna, there's no time. There's only Krishna personally. In other words, time is a regulative principle. How many days can you spend there? That means limitation. That's time. Time limits you to, you know, a stay in this particular body, a stay on this particular planet, a stay in this material world. That's time. It is the supreme regulative principle. All living beings are under the regulation of time. No matter, or, you know, some Patala Lok or anything in between. That is time. That is Krishna. But because we don't know Krishna personally, we are regulated or governed by Krishna's impersonal energy or influence, time. When you're governed by Krishna personally, there's no time. It is time. Then now all your activities are dictated to how long, well, so-called how long, but, you know, what activities, what pastimes you're engaged with Krishna in, that's all governed by Yoga Maya. She creates the situations for Krishna to engage in, you know, leelas with his devotees. And that's just a continuous flow. Nobody has any sense of past, present, and future. Well, it's all just the present. Whatever's going on right now. Therefore, Bhaktivinoda Thakur, he made that prayer. Forget the past that sleep at all, but act in times that are with thee, and progress ye shall call. You stay in the present. When you become more Krishna conscious, you don't really have an experience of the past and the future. You just, whatever's going on at the time, you're fully absorbed in that service. Fully absorbed, like Srila Prabhupada. Fully absorbed in his service at every single moment. Therefore, Prabhupada didn't, we were talking about this yesterday, Prabhupada didn't have a beginning and an end of his days. You know, we get up in the morning, we do our activities, we go to bed at night, we have 6 or 8 hours in ignorance. Bang, finished. The day's activities are gone. Then we wake up, we come back to our consciousness, and then we take up another day's activities. There's a clear demarcation between day and night, beginning and end of our activities. But Srila Prabhupada, there was no such, you know, demarcation. He would, well, it's hard to find a beginning point. Let's say we begin from the morning. You know, Prabhupada would go out on his morning walk. He would come back. He would greet the deities. He would receive Guru Puja. He would give his class. He'd go back. He'd have his breakfast. He would take 1 hour's rest after breakfast. Then he'd get up, he would deal with managerial things, do the mail, take his massage, you know, have his bath, take his lunch. Then again, 1 hour's rest in the afternoon. Then he would get up, he would receive visitors, give darshan, deal with, you know, various devotees, etc., etc., throughout the evening. Then at the night, 9:30, when we were all tired, we would go and take rest. Prabhupada would have a cup of hot milk, take his massage. Maybe he would rest for a half hour or an hour. Then he would get up, he would go in his sitting room, finish his rounds, and then he would translate all night long. End of the night time, you know, he would stop translating, freshen up, go out on his morning walk, and do the whole thing all over again, again and again and again. So where does his day begin and where does it end? It didn't. You know, an hour after breakfast, an hour after lunch for resting, maybe an hour at night time, and that was it. But Prabhupada was in a continuous state of Krishna consciousness, you know, activity. Always, every second, he was thinking about how to preach Krishna consciousness. So that's, you know, spiritual life. So no question of, you know, how many days can we spend in the Dham. You have to spend your entire existence in the Dham. That's the point that we have to come to. All right? All right, we're going to finish at this point with the association seminar. Jai Shri Shri Radha Gopinath Ki Jai. And just give us 1 second to get set up. You can all stand and stretch if you like for a minute. We'll just get the screen set up and then we'll show you what actually is the personal library of Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur. Okay, so I want to turn around so I can face the screen. You can leave this here.